three rooms of Mars, and when a planet gets to, when a body gets that small, it has much less about it that can fill. It has no atmosphere, it has almost no geologic process, and so on. Even those two turn out to be quite different from one another. We have yet to find two bodies in the solar system that we know enough about to be able to say that are alike. That are really alike. I think it's an extremely important fact. A lot of astronomers, more receptive than myself, assume that there can't be anything special about the Earth, and therefore we're here with millions of Earth-like planets out there, and therefore if the Earth has life here, it must be for a time. I'm sorry. I don't think that we know that. I'm not saying that I don't know. I'm saying we know so little we can't even put a probability on. But certainly in this solar system, there are 16 major worlds, number of moons as well as planets. And there seem to be 16 classes of worlds, each represented by one example. So how common is any single type, like the Earth? Is it so common that if we had 17, there'd be another? Or is it one in a billion? Or one in a trillion? We just do not have any way of knowing. But we keep finding out that every time we go in astronomy, from what we thought, to then finding out what we know. In other words, what was essentially an invention of the human mind to reality. Two things happen. Number one, it gets much more interesting. Nature is much more imaginative than we are. Number two, the reality turns out to be much more alien than we thought. Consider, for example, the difference between ancient myths of the structure of the universe and the grandiosity of the real universe, such as we know it, revealed by modern astrophysics. There's no comparison between all those billions of light years and the enormous numbers of galaxies and quasars and exploding galaxies and all this sort of thing and, you know, a flat disk on the back of a turtle on the back of an elephant or whatever the sequence was. But it's a lot less home. A lot of people like to find it right. A lot of people don't. I think, you know, you are here because you find it fascinating. But I think there are some people who are frightened by it, and I think really that is one of the psychological reasons for such objections to spaceflight as there are, which are very much less widespread and very much less severe than sometimes you're led to believe. But every once in a while you run into somebody who's just terrified by finding out how tiny a part of the universe we are and how very, very little most of us think of us. There are entire galaxies out there that are exploding, and they are going to keep on exploding whether you flunk your exam, or whether I get hit by a truck, or whether President Nixon gets kicked out of office or not, or whether the coal strike is settled or we all freeze. They're going to keep right on exploding. If the entire Earth were to disappear tomorrow, it would have virtually no effect on the universe, and I think a lot of people can't take that. Well, to that, I answer only, to use a term I despise, if you want to be well adjusted, you have got to accept the universe as it is, not as you like it to be. Ostriches, real ones, are smart enough not to hide their heads in the sand. We should be that smart also. So I'm a second time. All of this has gotten us away from Uranus, and the reason for that is that I don't really have very much that I can say about Uranus. What I'm trying to show you is that we don't know very much about that planet. Oh, we know something. It's five times the diameter of the Earth, so it's a lot bigger than the Earth is, but it's smaller than Jupiter and Saturn. Neptune is about the same size, and it is a Jovian planet as well. We do not know whether it's producing its own internal heat. We don't really know what it's made of, aside from the fact that it's not going to be rock. We don't know whether it's mostly hydrogen and helium in particular. It may be mostly water, methane, and ammonia instead. That's one of the things we hope to find out in Voyager 2, assuming that it can get to Uranus. And we know that it has five moons. And we know another thing, too, and that is that Uranus is unique in the solar system in that it is tilted almost on its side. What that means is there's one part of its orbit in which it literally rolls along like a barrel. Every other planet and every other moon that we've been able to measure this for, and even asteroids we've been able to measure it for, have rotation axes that are more or less perpendicular to their orbits. You know, it more or less stands upright. Such tillage you have gives you seasons on the planet. But the seasons are not that extreme on any other planet that we know of compared to what you've got on Uranus. On Uranus, number one, it rotates backwards. In other words, the sun would rise in the west and set in the east, it seems, of Uranus. But number two, the tilt of the axis is almost 90 degrees. It's only 8 degrees different from 90 degrees. What this means is you have some absolutely unbelievable seasons in Uranus. Let us start out at the same season of the year as we almost are here on Earth, and that is, believe it or not, the beginning of spring, and about time, I think. Let's start at the day of the vernal equinox, and consider that is the day when on any planet, no matter what its tilt, the sun rises due east and sets due west, or vice versa, as the case may be. So I'd like you to imagine that we're in a planetarium dome, and east is over there, and north is up here on the screen, and south is back there, and west is over there. Okay? On the vernal equinox and Uranus, if you were at the same point on the planet as you are here on Earth, that is latitude 43 degrees north, the sun would rise due west. It would travel across the sky in an arc like this, and it would set half a Uranus day later over there in the east. The next day, it would rise a microscopically tiny fraction farther north and move across the sky and set in the east. The day after that, again, a tiny, tiny, tiny bit farther north. And this would go on and on and on and on for decade after decade, because the Uranus year is 84 Earth years long. Finally, something like 25 or 30 years after we started, the day would come when the sun's rise point would have moved all the way up to the due north point on the horizon. And on that day, it would rise, make a circle in the sky like this, and touch that same point on the horizon again. From there on, for about the next 40 years, you would have continuous 24-hour-a-day sunlight, or whatever the number of hours of the Uranus day is. Slowly, day by day, the sun, making endless circles above the north horizon, would get its circle smaller and smaller and smaller, until finally, on the first day of summer, 21 years after we started, it would make a circle like this, 6 degrees in Uranus. Then the circles would begin to get bigger, and finally, the day would come when the sun would at last set. Then its circle would again get larger and larger until sunrise point would be farther and farther back along the horizon, until finally, 42 Earth years after we started, the sun would again rise due east, travel across the sky, and set due west. That is the beginning of autumn. The sunrise point would continue to move farther and farther towards the south until about, 10, 15 years into the autumn, I don't have to use numbers exactly, the sun would simply rise due south, peak above the horizon, and immediately set. Thereafter, there would be something of the order of 3 years of twilight, followed by something of the order of 20 years of continuous darkness. Followed by another 3 years of sunlight. Because what's happening is the sun is going farther and farther below the south horizon, and finally, on the first day of winter, it would make a circle the same distance below the south horizon as it was above the north horizon on the first day of summer, all right? And a circle of the same tiny size. Then the circle, which you can't see, below the horizon, would begin getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Finally, there would be another 3 years or so of twilight. Then the sun would again peak its head above the horizon, due south, and immediately disappear, and then begin making bigger and bigger circles until, at last, 84 Earth years after we started, it would again rise due east and set due west, and that is the beginning of the next one. As seen from the North Pole of Uranus, it would be even more incredible. On the first day of summer, the sun would make a tiny circle in the sky directly overhead. The pole at that time is the hottest place on the planet, not the equator. Uranus is the only planet that we know where the pole can be the hottest place on the planet. Once every 42 Earth years, the sun shines directly down onto one or the other of the poles of the Earth. What that means is that Uranus is the only place in the solar system where we can learn the important question, the important answer to one of the key questions of meteorology. We have always known that the heat engine that drives the weather on a planet is due to the sunlight coming from outside, in planets like the Earth, and that is rated somewhere around the equator. But we've also always known that the rotation of the planet has an important effect on the weather, and the rotational speed is also graded around the planet, around the equator. And we don't know how to separate those two variables. There's only one planet in the solar system, and then only once every 42 years when we can decouple those effects. When the hottest place on the planet is the pole, a full 90 degrees away from the place where the rotation is the greatest, the equator. If Voyager 2 is able to go to Uranus, it will arrive at Uranus at one of those times. So you see why we're writing for Uranus. Now mind you, it is not in the mission. That is a bonus. That is something we'll be able to do only if everything goes well. But it will be a very, very important thing to do. Well, to continue the description briefly of the pole, the circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and of course I'm really speeding this up, until finally the day comes when the sun simply circles around the horizon. Like that. And the Earth's pole as well. At the end of the period of the 6 months of continuous daylight, the sun simply circles around the horizon, makes about 3 days instead at the North Pole of the Earth, or the South Pole. On Uranus, it will take about 3 years to set. You will then have a decade or so of twilight and 42 years between sunset and sunrise, most of which would be continuous dark. So you have 42 years of continuous daylight and then 42 years of continuous darkness, except that the track of each of those is apportioned for the sunset period, the sunrise period, and the two twilights. Let's skip over to this slide. It shows that Uranus is bigger than we thought it was, and also shows the orientation. But I want to go on to the rings. Here are the moons of Uranus, all five of them. They are named for characters from Shakespeare: Miranda, Ariel, Umbriel, Titania, and Oberon. And that is about all that is known about them. They do. Here is something that is known about them. Their orbits, of course, are known well. Their physical nature is not. Even these, all five of them, remain in orbits that are strictly above the equator of the planet, even though that equator is tilted around at a more than 90 degree angle. That's telling you something very important about the formation of moons. We're not smart enough really to figure out what it is. But it obviously shows that the formation of the moons, in this case anyway, was related to the formation of the planet itself, in a sense. These are not captures. All right. The rings were discovered, as I said, a year ago tomorrow, by accident, in what was supposed to be a rather routine observation that you probably never would have heard of otherwise. And that is that Uranus passed directly between the Earth and a very faint star, which has some horrible catalog number they never bothered to memorize. The purpose of studying that, as you see, was visible, of course, it was only visible on the part of the Earth where it was night, and then this is the part where it was geometrically visible, where Uranus actually did cover the star. Up here it did not. And so you can see it's not exactly the easiest place in the world to get to. There are observatories in South Africa. There was an observatory in Perth, Australia, which was able to get the end of it. And to get the whole thing, some scientists from Cornell got into the Kuiper Airborne Observatory, named for George Kuiper, which is a telescope-bearing plane that NASA has an ancient search center. And they flew from Perth, Australia, out over the Indian Ocean, made observations, and then flew back. The reason they wanted to do that was that as the star disappears behind the edge of Uranus, There's a brief period there where it starts only shining through the atmosphere, and as it disappears, it shines through deeper and deeper and deeper layers. So by studying the exact way that the starlight disappears, the star fades out, you can learn some things about the atmosphere of Uranus. Okay, fine. Ironically, one of the greatest astronomical discoveries of the century was made because we did not know enough about the star. Its position was not terribly well known. You know, we've got several million stars cataloged by now, but some of them are better cataloged than others. And in this particular case, its position was poorly enough known, and the Uranus moved so darn slowly that they couldn't predict the time when this event, called occultation, when Uranus cuts off the light of the star. But at the time of the occultation could not be predicted better than plus or minus about an hour. So to be certain, they turned on the recorder an hour and a half or so in advance. I mean, why not? Chart paper's cheap. And to everybody's amazement, they discovered well before Uranus got to the star started flashing on and off. And of course, the first reaction was, oh, Lord, there's something wrong with the equipment. And when it became evident that there wasn't, they began to realize that something associated with Uranus was blocking the star for brief moments, and from the duration you could figure out the size of it, only a few miles across. And therefore, that there may well be moons around Uranus, was their first thought. So they then observed the occultation itself, got some data about given the atmosphere of Uranus, which by this time was not of as great interest. And then on the other side, of course, they got the atmosphere again, and then they waited expectantly. They not only got the star flashing on and off again, but, here came the clincher, the pattern was exactly the opposite of what had been on the way in. In other words, every time you had a flash on the way in, you had a flash on the way out, they were in the opposite order. So instead of being a bunch of moons, which of course would have been just randomly around Uranus, it had to be something that was symmetrical on both sides of the planet. The only thing we know of is symmetrical on both sides of a planet is a system of rings like that of Saturn. Then, observations from Kurtz and from South Africa were compared. Neither of those was able to see the entire occultation event, both going in and going out, but what they were able to see confirmed the Kuiper Airborne Observatory data, and since those were in slightly different places on the Earth, they got a slightly different cross-section of the rings, okay? Slightly different portions of the rings went between the star and Kurtz than between the star and the Kuiper Airborne Observatory in different points on the Earth. And so we've seen altogether about 1% of the rings. And I want to emphasize that all we've ever seen, we do not have any photograph of the rings. From the fact that it seems not to be possible to take them, you can calculate how bright the rings are, and they are so faint that, given the fact that we know how thick each one of them is from the duration of the occultation, we can calculate the albedo of the particles that they're made of, and they must be probably 100. There's nothing else to know that's black, especially with comets. I mean, it's not going to be obsidian, for example. It's not going to be slate. Those are materials that have a very special origin. So we know quite a bit about them, considering we've never seen them. But there are a lot of problems with them. This was basically what was seen from the Kuiper Airborne Observatory and then other observatories got antennas which were about like this and about like this. Okay? As you see, the rings look rather different from those of Saturn. For one thing, they are different in size, but of course that's not too surprising. The planet is different in size. But for another, here's an artist's conception of what conceivably they look like, which I love. This is not the famous one, the painting by Rick Sternbach, which you saw all over at the time. But this, I think, gives you a better idea of what the rings look like, and also, it really gives you the feeling for that other night in the outer solar system. You're 2 billion miles from the sun here. And the sun is visible as a tiny disk, but it is not anything like as bright as it is from the Earth. It's still too bright to look at with your naked eye, but you still have an awfully dim kind of view. And you notice that the rings look quite different from those of Saturn, in that they're so thin, they look like threads. In fact, what happens is they are mostly faint. They're mostly Cassini's divisions, if you want to think of it that way. You go out from Uranus 10,000 miles, and you finally hit the innermost ring, and it is only 3 miles across. Then you go out another 500 miles, and you hit another ring that is only 3 miles across. Then you go another several hundred miles, and you hit another kind of ring. There are three different kinds of these rings. The one that you hit is not shown on this painting because it was not known at the time the painting was done. It made a very tiny effect on the white curve of the star, so tiny that it was not noticed until computer processing had begun, that sort of thing. But what you get is a ring that is 10 times as broad as these earlier ones, in fact, more than 10 times, 60 miles across, but is very, very diffuse, so much so that it hardly affected the brightness of the star at all, just a little bit, 2%. Then you go another several hundred miles, and you hit another of these dense but thin rings, a few miles across. Go another several hundred miles, and you get still another of these dense but thin rings. So if you lost track, there are four of them all together. Two, and then the diffuse broad one, and then two more. And then you go out 2,000 miles, and you hit the third type of ring, and that is a thick one, well, still terribly thin by Saturn's standards, but it's 60 miles across, and yet a dense one. And so most of the ring material must be in this outermost ring. And the most incredible thing about the outermost ring is that it is either not in exactly the same plane as the others, it's tilted by about a degree or two, or else it is not perfectly circular. Either of those is absolutely impossible. In fact, the rings of Saturn, of Uranus, are so difficult to understand that they are a major theoretical challenge at the moment. They are so different from those of Saturn that we cannot understand how they can exist. One, what force is keeping the particles concentrated in those incredibly narrow bands? Why are they not spreading out over a large region of space? You say, well, maybe they are continuous the division. Uranus has five moons. Where would they perturb bodies in such a way as to keep them from being in those places? And the answer turns out, in most cases, not to be where we see these divisions. There are a couple of cases where you can get two moons' gravities acting together to cause perturbations, which correspond to some of the divisions, but not all. You say, could there be moons of Uranus that we just haven't discovered yet that are affecting? The answer is quite likely there are moons of Uranus we haven't discovered yet, but if we haven't discovered them, then they're even smaller than the ones that we already know, and those are already so small that the gravitational effects are pretty tiny. And above all, how can the outer ring be either tilted or not circular? Consider what it means to say it's not circular. Remember, that's not a single object. That's a huge collection of tiny particles, each in its own orbit. And some of those, the ones on the inner edge of the ring, are very slightly closer to Uranus than the ones on the outer edge of the ring, which means they are going at a very slightly greater speed, which means that if they start out in such a way that all of them are in the same non-circular shape, very quickly what's going to happen is some of them are going to start moving faster than others, and they're going to spread around until you get a circular band, whether you started out with one or not. How long would it take for that to happen? Is it just such a long process that it's longer than the ancient solar system, 4.6 billion years? Unfortunately, it turns out to be a little shorter than that. It turns out to be 20 years. So either the rings of Uranus have formed within the last 20 years, which, let's say, we don't really take very seriously, or else there's something going on here that we simply do not understand. And the problem with the tilt is the same thing. You can't have a ring that's tilted with respect to the others. Those inclinations are determined by the gravities of Uranus and the satellites. And if you have a tilt, what's going to happen is some of them, again, will be going faster than others. And so what you will get will be, very quickly, a donut-shaped cloud. Not a single ring, all of which is tilted by the same amount. Nobody will be bothered by a lot of random orbits and random tilts, although, as I explained about the rings of Saturn, that's got to collapse to a disk eventually. But it could take long enough to do it, but if there's been a collision there within the last, tens of millions of years, which is utterly out of the question, then perhaps it would still happen. But a ring in which all of the particles are tilted all by the same amount and all in the same direction? No way. No way. And here comes the last problem. This year, last month in fact, January, 2 months ago now, Uranus again passed between the Earth and the same star. Uranus itself didn't cover the star, but the ring should have. There was apparently only one observation made. I have very little information on this. I haven't been able to get through to the person, so all I've got is a news article. But apparently, only one observation was made, and two of the rings just weren't there. So, I do not know from this whether that means the others were, or whether it means only the outermost two should have called it a star. But, in any case, two of them weren't there. So what that may be is that the rings are not complete bands. And in fact, even in the original occultation, there are some faint dips in the curve which make it look as though there's some partial bands. And that is absolutely preposterous. Because the ring particles should be moving at different speeds, and they should very quickly spread out until they're all the way around the planet. At the moment, therefore, I simply have to leave you with a mystery. We do not understand the rings of Uranus at all. But one thing is very, very clear, and that is they are very, very different from those of Saturn. Here are four pictures of Neptune taken at a time in 1958 when it occulted a star. In fact, the star is bright as itself. Remember, please, the size of this image is not the true size of the star. It depends on the brightness. And there comes Neptune, and that little dot next to it is the big moon Triton. We know so little by the time you get this far from the sun that Triton may be the biggest moon in the solar system. Ganymede and Titan, which are respectively the biggest moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and fighting it out for that title all through this century. They're almost the same size, and every time somebody redetermines one of them a little more precisely, one or the other pulls ahead. And now it looks as though the winner may be a dark horse. It may be Triton. Don't confuse Triton and Titan, by the way. They're kind of confusing nomenclature. Anyway, here is Triton revolving around Neptune, and you can see orbital motion in photographs. I don't know if you've ever actually seen that before. And you can also see Neptune's orbital motion around the sun just by the star. Neptune, as I mentioned, is the same size as Uranus. It's green. It has two known moons. They seem to be in some sort of disarray. It does not have the weird axial tilt that Uranus has. We don't know the length of its day. We thought we did. Again, it was determined back in the 1930s by a couple of people who had nothing better to do, and nobody had bothered to check it in all the intervening time. And somebody finally did check it, and we've got results that are so indeterminate that we just don't know what the length of the day is, and that is what we know about Neptune, that orbital period and that kind of thing. Here is the discoverer of Pluto, Clyde Tombaugh, again at a Blink microscope. He is the only living discoverer of a planet. This was taken when he was a good deal younger, and he discovered it in 1930. One of the thrills of my being there at JPL to cover Viking was that during that summer that he showed up at JPL and I got to meet him, and that was quite a thing, you know, to talk to the discoverer of a planet. Pluto is even less known than the others in the outer solar system, so little we don't even know its size. And from this picture you can see why. These two pictures of Pluto taken one day apart. And you can see how very, very little is moved in that day. Pluto takes 247 Earth years to go around the sun once. Which means that I don't care how old you are, if you've been born on Pluto, you would never see your first birthday. And indeed, it'll be a long time before Pluto even returns to the place in the sky where it was discovered. I am probably the only person to ever meet who has actually seen Pluto through a telescope. And in fact, it took some doing. The object is very, very faint. It is very, very hard to see, even when it's as close to the sun as it is now. Well, these two pictures were taken as the biggest telescope on Earth at the time, still the second biggest, the 200-inch of Mount Palomar, and that's the best that we can see. We don't know its size, we don't know what it's made of. It's covered by frozen methane that was discovered last year. But what it's made of, we can't say. We do not know how heavy it is. That's an irony. You may know that Neptune was discovered because of deviations of Uranus from the orbit that it should have carried, it should have followed. In other words, Herschel discovered Uranus on March 13, 1781. We're coming up to the 200th anniversary of that. And in the decades that followed, there were enough observations that its orbit could be kept pretty heavy very accurately calculated. And then it turned out it simply did not follow the orbit that was calculated. So either there was something wrong with the interval of gravity, or, and this is what they suspected, it turned out to be right, there was an unknown planet out beyond Uranus that was perturbing its orbit. So they look, you can calculate the perturbation roughly where it should have been, and lo and behold, there it was. There was that kind of great triumph of Newtonian physics. Well, after a while, it became evident that even with Neptune, there was still slight perturbations in Uranus's orbit that didn't seem to be accounted for. And so again, the same thing was tried, and it was predicted where the outermost planet, Planet X, they call it, would be, and after a long search, Triton finally found it pretty close to Planet X. Far enough away, it took a long search, especially with Pluto's so faint. And that was a big shock, but it was so faint. It was not another giant Jovian planet, like the others. It was a little bitty thing. Somehow we do not know what its size is. But it now appears that the supposed perturbation in the orbit of Uranus that we used to discover Pluto, in fact, were observational errors. And it is absolutely clear that there is no way that Pluto, no matter what it is made of, and no matter what size, could have a gravity, could be big enough and heavy enough, to have a gravity that is great enough to have caused these supposed perturbations. And so the discovery of Pluto, it's very hard to say this because it just seems so unbelievable. But apparently, the discovery of Pluto is simply the most unbelievable coincidence in the history of science. It was where it was supposed to be. I can think of only other one other case that's even superficially like that. In the last century, when a comet is discovered, it's not telegram to other observatories, so it's never right away. The comet's unavoidable very long, and you want to observe it real fast and get it burned so you don't lose it. So that system was just being set up around that middle of the last century, 1860s as well. And a particular comet was discovered, and the numbers that astronomers used to specify images in the sky were sent out to a number of observatories by telegram. One observatory got a telegram in which the numbers had been garbled. They were incorrect. And so, of course, they didn't know this. They took their telescope, they looked at the position in the sky specified by the numbers, and there were comets. It was several days before they realized that it was not the same comet and that they had discovered a new one. Fortunately, they had enough observations of it by then that it was not alive also, and so they got different kinds of ones. You know, the joke is the summertime on Pluto is when the air melts, but in fact, it doesn't look that warm. Pluto is coming closer to the sun now, and we shall have a chance to see whether there is any other frozen gas mixed in with the methane, which will turn into a gas and give Pluto a temporary atmosphere, but it seems unlikely, although, well, there are stranger stories than that in the outer solar system. Io, as I told you last time, freezes out its entire atmosphere four times a week, and then a couple of hours later regenerates it into gas. And other than that, we just don't know anything about Pluto. We're not going to find out for a while either. The end of this decade, 1977 through 1979, is a period when you could launch a single spacecraft to Jupiter in such a way that Jupiter's gravity would deflect it by exactly the right amount and change its speed by exactly the right amount to send it on to Saturn. And that is exactly what we're going to do with the Voyager. You can fly past Saturn in such a way as to have Saturn's gravity send you on to Uranus. You can have Uranus's gravity send you on to Neptune. And you can have Neptune's gravity send you on to Pluto. That kind of arrangement, which I'm sick and tired of reading as a lineup, by the way, is not a lineup at all. The planets are spread all across the sky. They are never going to be lined up, certain popular crank books to the contrary. They are never going to be at all lined up. In fact, it's a mathematical impossibility. There are numerical commensurabilities or periods to prevent it. But they are in such a position that you can send a single spacecraft all the way from Earth to Pluto in 9 years and visit all of those other worlds in between. To go under ordinary conditions, at ordinary times, it would take 45 years and you would have only Pluto. An opportunity like that happens only once every 175 years. In other words, the last time it happened, Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States. And the next time is in the middle of the 22nd century. At the beginning of this decade, there was a plan for a mission, which was called the Grand Tour, to do exactly this. And one of the wonderful things
President Nixon did to the country was to kill the grand jury.
We will have another chance in 175 years. Voyager is an attempt to recover as much as possible of the grand jury. The Voyagers will go to Jupiter, of course. They will then go on to Saturn. And if all goes well, Voyager 2, you see, all goes well, Saturn with Voyager 1, Voyager 2 will go on to Europe. The difficulty is that if you use this flyby capability to go on to the next planet, you've got to fly past at a particular location, at a particular direction, at a particular speed. And that may not be terribly good for making scientific observations of the planet while on its moon. So you pretty well have to choose, are we going to observe Saturn with this thing, or are we going on to Europe and get some observations of Saturn to be sure, and some moons that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. There's just so much richness out there that almost no matter what you do, you're going to get something. But it wouldn't be optimal for Saturn, you would not get Titan. And the way you settle that is just have enough spacecraft to handle it all. In the case of Grand Tour, there are going to be four separate spacecraft, and that was enough that if all went well, you could have sent one of them on to Pluto. They were scared about the rings of Saturn, so in fact, no single spacecraft would have gone to all five of them. There wouldn't have been any Jupiter-Saturn-Uranus mission, and there would, I'm sorry, a Jupiter-Saturn-Pluto mission, and then there would have been a Jupiter-Uranus-Neptune mission, skipping Saturn, which you can do if you wish. But with the Voyagers, we don't have that capability, and it turns out that if you fly past Uranus, in the way it will send you on to Neptune, you essentially lose Uranus. You don't see the pole, you don't see the rings, you don't get the moon, you just throw away Uranus. So almost certainly what will be done is Voyager 1 will go to Jupiter and Saturn only, that's for sure, that's decided already, and it will get Titan on the way. You cannot get Titan if you go to Uranus. Voyager 2, if Voyager 1 is able to do all that, will go to Jupiter, Saturn, skipping Titan, and then on to Uranus, but it will not go further than Uranus. So what has happened essentially is we have lost Neptune and we lost Pluto, and there is no present plan, even speculative, to do something about that, to have other spacecraft later on will go to Jupiter. Let us have an intermission at this point. This is the end of the main part of the lecture. And afterwards, for those of you who can stay and are interested, could we have the lights on there in the back before everybody stumbles and falls? For those of you who can stay and are interested, get the switch right over there by the door. There you go, great. Thank you. For those of you who can stay, we will have another basic lecture about Voyager immediately after. Okay, let's get started again. Someone has turned off my projector, so that same person will be kind enough to turn it back on.
Thanks a lot, by the way. My kids, my little girl enjoys
it. Oh, that's great. Tremendous. Listen, you ready to go planetary and tell them that I'll be back?
No, well, you know, I took her out of ticket on Ann
Arbor. Uh-huh, tremendous. Well, that's great. Question here.
Yes, I'm on the Uranus photograph where they had the severe computer processing of 17 images.
Right.
Could we be doing the same thing we did with Mars in blue images prior to Mariner 9, I guess?
I doubt it because you're not blue images for one thing.
I'm just wondering, could we be over-processing our data like we were doing on Mars? We're trying to make it an image and really it wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah. Anything is possible. I think it's unlikely. For one thing, there does seem to be a very thin band of cross-section about the position where you expect the shadow of the rings. Now, that may be wishful thinking, there were photographs that show canals too, but it seems likely that, that what you saw here was real. But we don't know. I mean, that's the reason that I showed the picture, but we just can't tell. Even with our best pictures, we can't tell what Uranus looks like. And that's why Voyager 2 is going to be, one of these Voyager 2 will be so important, I think. Okay, there are a couple of people going out just now. Could you flip the light switch by the door there as you pass by? Oh, all right, thank you. I didn't know there was one inside. Okay, you are thinking of a hardcore, fine. This is a picture of the way the spacecraft, as you see, the heater ones are identical. It is basically a Mariner, really. As a matter of fact, Voyager was originally called Mariner, Jupiter, Saturn. And I suppose that the two spacecraft would have been called Mariner 11 and Mariner 12. And then, only a few months before the launch last year, the JPL people and the NASA headquarters people decided that this was really a special enough mission, and the spacecraft had evolved enough since the early Mariner days, it's been Mariner for quite a while, that it was worthwhile getting a different name. It certainly looks different from a Mariner. Actually, that's a little misleading. The basic part of the spacecraft is this ring, this 10-sided ring. That's where all the electronics are in. That's 6 feet across the end of the scale. And that is a Mariner spacecraft body. You know, so if you take a Mariner spacecraft, you pull off all the legs and wings, and stick on new ones, you got a Voyager. And it may look very different, but in fact the body is still the same thing. When I say legs and wings, I mean it. The spacecraft is dominated by this enormous antenna. This antenna is to send back the signals from that from the distances that it's going to get out to, and it will be on Earth. The antenna is 12 feet across. You can park a small car under it. And then, in addition, sticking out from the box, which is what you call this ring, are booms, which are what you call the arms, or legs, if you want to think of them that way. Those have on them most of the scientific instruments. This is the one called the science boom, and it has, as you see, the camera, which is right there, imaging narrow angle. That's the narrow angle lens, that's the telephoto, the one that gives the detail, and imaging wide angle. It has an ultraviolet spectrometer to find out what atmospheres are made of. It has an infrared spectrometer and radiometer to measure temperatures and also do some more finding out of what things are made of. It has experiments which are called, more or less arbitrarily, plasma, cosmic ray, and low-energy charged particle. In fact, those are all observing particles, fragments of atoms in space, whether they come from the sun, the solar wind, in other words, from Jupiter or Saturn. We know that Jupiter has an intense particle environment, the radiation belts around it. I talked about that last time. Saturn may, we don't know. Confusion, the rings are right about where the particle belts would be. Possible those ring particles have been able to, I'm using the word particle in two different senses here, it's possible that the chunks that make up the rings would be able to sweep up all the fragments of atoms, the protons and electrons and so on that otherwise would be there. We know the moons of Jupiter do that, and when you have a large number of particles doing the sweeping, it could be very effective. So we'll find out about that. And also, eventually, it will be observing subatomic particles from interstellar space. So those differ from one another really in the amount of energy that they receive. Photopolarimeter is a device which measures brightnesses and also degrees of polarization. Some of you know what that means, and for the rest, well, yeah, I can't tell you anything, don't worry about it. The boom down here, this one is 43 feet long, and so it extends way out of the picture. And it's those booms that make the whole thing look like a spider. You know, you look at it from the front especially, and it looks like a spider holding up a shield, or holding the shield the wrong way, because this antenna, of course, curves in this direction. This boom is made of epoxy glass. It is a very remarkable structure. It is all folded up at the time of launch into a little can that's only about the size of a shoebox. And when the spacecraft is safely launched, obviously you can't launch it without the boom sticking out, right? I mean, they snap apart. And so all of them are folded up or curled up in one way or another. And the most difficult part of the early mission is not the launch at all, it is deploying those booms after you get into space. And in fact, as you may remember, and if you don't, you'll see in a moment, we had some problems with that when the first Voyager launched. We didn't have a problem, ironically, with this 43-foot-long magnetometer boom. The reason it's so long is that it's magnetometers. They measure magnetic fields. I assume that's obvious from the name. Well, it's not obvious from the name. They measure magnetic fields of the planets in an interplanetary space and eventually interstellar space. And magnetometer boom.
The reason it's so long is that it's magnetometers. They measure magnetic fields. I assume that's obvious from the, well, it's not obvious from the name. They measure magnetic fields of the planets and of interplanetary space and eventually interstellar space. And they're very sensitive. And with all this electrical activity up there in the bus and with the other instruments, you have to get them well away from the spacecraft itself, or else you're simply going to measure all the magnetic fields that are generated by the electric activity on the spacecraft. So, you have the magnetometer boom, which is so, it's an open truss work, as you see. It is so lightweight, it weighs only 5 pounds. It weighs less than the power cord, which it carries out to the magnetometer along its middle. And it is all twisted in such a way that all of the empty space between the slats of the truss is taken up. So it's just folded up, twisted up against itself. When you get into space, the can pops open, low explosive charge, a spring drives the magnetometer boom out, it unwinds, there's a lanyard which is pulling backwards against it so that it doesn't come out too fast. It unwinds and extends itself to a length of 43 feet, a size of a four-story building, while rotating around 22 complete circles and a fraction at the end. And it comes to rest with the magnetometers in position within plus or minus 1 degree of where they should be in the 360-degree rotation. There are very few people who can screw around that precisely, I'll tell you. The second longest booms are two of them, of which only one is well shown here, and they're hard to understand in a two-dimensional perspective diagram like this because they are perpendicular to each other and to the magnetometer boom, and any one of those axes is at a 45-degree angle to the two big booms, which are what you obviously look at, you see, when you're looking at the picture. So if you can imagine all that, they're just sticking out at various angles, and these are just what they look like. They look like a pair of rabbit ears, so that's what they are. They are antennae, which are used for two things. One, to study something called plasma waves, which I'm not even going to try to tell you about, and the other, to make the first radio astronomical observations ever made by a planetary spacecraft. The reason for that will be obvious if you were here last time. Jupiter has very intense radio emission at a number of different frequencies, and in fact, we know that Uranus has some radio emission. It is possible that Saturn does. There are some sort of ambiguous observations that it may produce a little bit. So those observations will be made directly. Now this is just a pair of rabbit ears. It has no directionality whatsoever. But by making enough observations over a long enough period of time and observing how intensities of signals vary as the spacecraft moves around the planet and is at different distances from the planet, you can separate out various sources that you might be getting. So that should be especially interesting, and we'll be seeing a number of things there. On the opposite side, here's the science boom, and that's short but heavy. On the opposite side of that, therefore, of the spacecraft from that, is the other short heavy boom, and that is the one which carries the three RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which are the radioactive power sources. These are nuclear power sources. We got in just under the wire. Cosmos 954 had not yet re-entered, and so it was still okay to launch nuclear-powered spacecraft without everybody screaming at you. Now, of course, it still should be in the case of something like this, because these are planetary spacecraft, and they're never going to re-enter. But just try to explain that to the average man in the street, or worse yet, the average congressman. And I don't know if there is really a ban on nuclear-powered spacecraft, which I would love to see if it was restricted to Earth orbital spacecraft. You know, because putting a nuclear power source in a spacecraft that's going to re-enter is just unbelievable stupidity. And we're really going to pay for it as a result. I suspect that it is not going, if it is enacted at all, it will not be restricted to Earth orbital spacecraft, and I don't know what's going to come about our solar system exploration as a result. You can't use solar power out there, you're just too far from the sun. These three generators give you more power than the two smaller generators on the Pioneer Jupiter spacecraft, Pioneers 10 and 11, and that's just one of the many respects in which Voyager is just a fancier, more sophisticated, more heavy-duty mission. Well, that's what the spacecraft looks like. Here is the list of the names from which Voyager was chosen. There is Voyager, where is it? There we go, right down there. And this was the entire list, lovingly collated by Jonathan Eberhard again from Science News. And I think you can see that the committee had quite a job And I think you can see there could have been some highly unfortunate choices. I can just picture forager. Well, I just found some nuts and berries growing at Jupiter. What do you want me to do with them, George? Not to mention entropy. Well, you can also see, though, that there are, Sounder, that's the name for the famous dog, I suppose. Sleuth, can you imagine how that would have sounded on all the newscasts? Sleuth 1 arrived at Uranus today, as they would undoubtedly pronounce it. Okay, Voyager's pretty good, but there's some others that are that are pretty nice. I like Vaquero. There's some others that are pretty good. And the point is that apparently, from now on, spacecraft, at least on planetary missions, are all going to have their own names. You have Viking, and there's never going to be another Viking. Even if we send something else to Mars, it's almost certainly going to be called something else. And these will be the only Voyagers, and so on. And I'm wondering if they're going to name Pioneer Venus something else by the time they launch it. I noticed that nobody seems to be referring to the two Pioneer Venus spacecraft as Pioneer 12 and Pioneer 13, which is what they would logically be. And in fact, they have zero relation, practically, to the earlier Pioneer spacecraft as far as being the same kind of spacecraft is concerned. In fact, the Voyagers are much more mariners than the so-called Pioneer Venus spacecraft are Pioneers, compared to, say, Pioneer 11, Pioneer Standard 11 that went to Jupiter. The only reason they're called Pioneers is the Pioneer is the name for a planetary or interplanetary spacecraft launched by Ames Research Center as compared to a Mariner, which is a JPL spacecraft. Well, now all planetary spacecraft are going to be JPL, a decision that was made a few years ago. And so apparently what we're going to do is instead of calling every one of them Mariner umpty ump from now on, every mission is going to have its own separate name. Voyager 2 was launched before Voyager 1. That was in order to make sure you were confused. See, there's a problem. Voyager 2 was only the second fastest spacecraft that ever left the Earth. Voyager 1, which was launched 16 days later, was the fastest spacecraft ever to leave the Earth. Voyager 1 left the Earth at 32,641 miles per hour, which means that it could have gone from East Lansing to Detroit in 9 seconds. And it traveled, in fact, the distance from the Earth to the Moon in 8.5 hours, as compared to 3 days for Apollo. Voyager 2 was 156 miles an hour slower. And so even though Voyager 2 was launched 16 days earlier, in the middle of December of last year, they passed one another, not in the sense that they were within sight of one another, they were in fact 10.5 million miles apart, but they were the same distance from the Sun. They were in fact just outside the orbit of Mars, just about to enter the asteroid belt. And thereafter, Voyager 1 leaves. So the point is that the spacecraft that is launched second gets there first. Now, given that fact, how are you going to name them? Are you going to name them in order of arrival, in which case you have a few weeks of confusion back when they were launched, or are you going to name them in order of launch, in which case you have years of confusion afterwards when over and over you have to explain to people that Voyager 2 was arriving ahead of Voyager 1? Well, they decided it was better to have a few weeks of confusion at the time of launch, and so they named them in order of arrival time, and this is the Voyager 2 launch, and it went first. The launch vehicle is a Titan Centaur. This is a historic moment. Well, actually, the second one, Voyager 1, was the historic moment. The last Titan Centaur ever launched. And the Titan Centaur is the last expendable rocket that the U.S. will ever develop, as opposed to the reusable space shuttle, where you use the same vehicle over and over again for one mission after another. This is the last rocket that we ever developed designed to have each one of the rockets of its class built used only once for one mission and then thrown away. The Titan Centaur was originally developed for Viking. It was used twice for Viking, both successfully, as you probably know. It was then used for Helios, the German-American sun probes. Both of those were successful. Finally, it was used for Voyager, and both of those were successful. And so the Titan Centaur has the enviable record of a 100% operational success record in the six uses that were made of it. There was one earlier Titan Centaur that was launched, and that was a test vehicle before any of the operational uses, and it was the only failure of the entire set. It blew up. But it blew up in such a way that it was fairly obvious to figure out how it happened, and so instead of having another test launch, they went right ahead with the first operational use, and everyone thereafter just worked out beautifully. It's a strange-looking vehicle, as you can see. For one thing, the Centaur is wider than the Titan, And so you have what is called a hammerhead configuration. For another, the Titan has strapped to its side two solid rocket boosters to help it take off. And I mean literally strapped. Those are the straps. And so the whole thing taking off is with these two solid fuel boosters going, and in fact only with them going. I have never been able to find out why, and it seems contrary to everything that I know about why you have multi-stage rockets in the first place, but the Titan does not fire its engine until the solids have completely finished and have broken off. They're broken off by little explosive charges which sever the straps, and then they fall into the ocean. So then, a minute and 58 seconds after launch, is when the Titan main engine down there burns. And why they do it that way, I can't tell you. These were the highest energy unmanned launches that have ever been done from Earth. To get the Voyagers on the way to Jupiter required two solid fuel strap-on boosters, two stages of the Titan, the Centaur, which was burned twice with a 43-minute coast period in between, and then a separate small rocket fastened to the back of the spacecraft itself, which you did not see in that last picture because that picture shows what it looks like after that rocket is jettisoned, which it is as soon as the spacecraft is on the way to the planets. And as I said, they left the Earth faster than any other spacecraft ever has. What? Yeah?
How does this compare to some of the manned launch vehicles we've used?
How does it compare in size to some of the manned launch vehicles we've used?
Just trying to get an idea.
Yeah, I don't, the short answer to that is I don't know. the thrust of the solids is one, excuse me, is 1.5 million pounds, whereas Saturn V is 6 million pounds. But that's a Saturn V, and how that would compare with a Saturn 1B for either size or thrust, I just don't know. Anybody happen to know either the size or thrust of a Saturn 1B? Geminis were launched with Titans, but just the Titan. You didn't have the Centaur, you didn't have the strap-ons. So there, your answer would be that was a considerably weaker rocket. Yeah, that's a good answer. I'd forgotten all about Gemini. I was thinking in terms of Saturn 1Bs. I suspect they're comparable within a factor of some small number, but beyond that, I'd hate to say. Well. Everything went fine in the launch itself of the first Voyager, but when it came time to deploy the booms, there were some problems. Here is a model of the spacecraft with a typical JPL employee for scale, and you can see behind her there. Please look behind her. I want you to look at the spacecraft. This is a full-scale model of the spacecraft minus the propulsion module, which is down here. That's the little rocket that's fastened to it. This is a full-scale model with everything deployed except that the two radio astronomy antennae are not nearly long enough. They should be 33 feet long. And the magnetometer boom they just gave up on. And it is displayed here in the stowed position, the position in which it's launched. So what happens is this cover comes off and then slowly it unscrews itself and goes way, way out like that. Well, the RTG boom here and the science boom over on the other side for launch are folded down against the side of the spacecraft like this. And then when they deploy, they are supposed to come up to a 90-degree angle like this and then lock into place, okay? What locks them into place is there's a little bent elbow device in here. And as the arm comes up, that elbow straightens. And when the arm is at 90 degrees, the elbow is at 180 degrees, and it snaps into place, and then locks itself. At that time, when it snaps into place, it sends back a signal to Earth confirming that it has indeed locked into place. And what sends it is the final action in that whole sequence, the actual locking, the little pin dropping down. Well, in the case of the RTG boom, the elbow locked perfectly. But in the case of the science boom for the first launch, Voyager 2, we never got the signal that it had locked. There was a lot of fear that what might have happened was that the RTG boom had come out okay, the science boom was still folded against the side of the spacecraft, in which case you have terrible balance problems. And you use up your attitude control system fuel, the fuel, which in this case is hydrazine, which does not have to be lighted or anything. It decomposes spontaneously and generates gas, which is then squirted out of nozzles. So it's a very reliable system. That is used, and this is the first time it's ever been done, both for attitude control and for any orbit maneuvers, any changes in the trajectory the spacecraft will make after it is actually launched. So you can use, you have a single supply of fuel, and you can divvy it up with those two uses as you want. And that way, if you got, we've had other spacecraft where you had two separate systems, each with its own fuel supply, and there came a time when you were out of fuel for one, you had plenty of fuel still left in the other, and you really wished there was just some way that you could move fuel from the one hand to the other. Well, now you've got that capability. The problem is that if the balance had been that bad, you would have, in the first place, you would have gotten probably lousy science observations, because the science boom was supposed to be sticking out there at that 90-degree angle. The reason for it being that way the cameras and the other instruments on the movable hand, you might as well call it, scan platform at the end of the boom, can peer over the edge of the dish, and they can be moved around in a bunch of different directions so that they can observe in one direction even though the antenna is pointed in a different direction. Well, the fear was that not only would you not get very good science observations, but also you'd have such a bad problem with the balance that the spacecraft would use up all of its supply of attitude control gas. Very quickly, it became evident from making observations with the science instruments that, in fact, the boom was almost all the way out. For example, they turned on the plasma instrument and it started faithfully observing the solar wind, and the solar wind was hitting it from just the direction that it should have if the boom were in the right position, you know, and things like that. Then they used the cameras, aimed them in the known location, and photographed star fields, and they got exactly what the stars should have been in the right directions. So apparently what happened was the spring, there are two springs, one on either side. That's not true on this one. There was one single spring, and this spring uncoils and forces the boom out like so. And in order that it doesn't send the boom going up wham and maybe do some damage, there is a viscous fluid in a little container there which damps the motion as it gets near the end. And apparently the spring was a little bit too weak, or you can think of it as being the viscous fluid was a little bit too strong. And so you went almost all the way to the stowed position, but not quite. It is now known to be within a degree or so of the right position. But if you think about the geometry for a moment, the little elbow is still at a 30-degree angle, even if this arm was almost in the right position. In fact, 30-degree is the correct figure. So it never snapped. But as a result of our friend the Vincent's fluid, the arm is locked solidly enough into space, into place, that when you move the cameras around, it won't move the boom, which was the other fear. You see, because then you never would have known which way you were pointing. And these cameras are unbelievably high magnification, so you've got to know exactly which way you're pointing, or else you won't even be able to aim at the object you want to photograph, let alone not knowing the exact direction that you're pointing. Well, they solved the problem in a very straightforward manner for Voyager 1, the second one launched. They simply added 6 additional springs, and there they had no trouble whatsoever. 3 on each boom. They put 3 on the RTG boom, even though they had no trouble with that on the first spacecraft, because there's the possibility they might have. And there, the little elbow did lock into place, and we got the signal, and everything was fine. The other problems that were involved in the launch of Voyager 2 were all computer errors. And as usual, that term doesn't mean anything wrong with the computer. It means human error. It means an error in the person who programmed the computer. But I don't mean by that any criticism of the computer programmers. These spacecraft have the smartest computers that have ever been flown on any unmanned vehicle. They have to. They're going so far from home that it will take hours, literally, for radio signals traveling at the speed of light to go from the spacecraft to the Earth and then for the return signal to go back to the spacecraft. Which means that if something goes wrong and you try to control it from the ground, you waited until you knew about it on the ground to send the corrective measures, and then the corrective measures had to travel back to the spacecraft, it could be hours after the emergency occurred. And that, in many cases, could be too late. So, the spacecraft were designed so that they had computers that were capable of doing a great deal of thinking for themselves. They could diagnose and, on their own, correct many routine kinds of malfunctions that might occur. Well, the computers had to be told how to do this. And what happened was, the computers, nobody had ever had any experience programming computers that were this clever before. And while you can do a certain number of tests on the ground, that doesn't duplicate the space environment, especially weightlessness. To a certain extent, you just gotta learn on the job and hope you don't make any fatal mistakes. And what happened was, a number of times, the first few days after launch, it turned out the computer had been programmed to be too cowardly. And some little tiny thing would go wrong, which in fact was within the region of tolerance. And the computer would panic and throw the spacecraft in some emergency safe mode, which involved doing things like shutting down all the data observations and turning off everything that wasn't absolutely essential, maybe pointing in a different direction, so forth and so on. And in fact, the computer was simply having a set of nerves as a result of the instructions it had been given. So what they did, as soon as this became evident, was send up a new program, which reprogrammed it to be a good deal more venturesome. And they reprogrammed the same thing into the Voyager 1 computer, which is still on the ground. And thereafter, there were no problems with either Voyager 2 or Voyager 1, whose launch and early flight were just textbook perfect from beginning to end. So, again, you may have heard a lot about the problems in the early part of the flight of Voyager 2, and the important thing, the bottom line, is they're all fixed. And we've got a healthy spacecraft. We've got two healthy spacecraft. Here's a diagram of how they look on the way out. At this scale, their two orbits are practically identical until they begin to diverge up here. And Voyager 1, which remember was launched second, are the black dots. Voyager 2, which was launched first, are the white dots. And this shows the process in which the two spacecraft pass by one another just outside the orbit of Mars. Right there was where it happened, December 15th or thereabouts. Here is a very beautiful, I think, painting by Adolf Schauer showing a Voyager spacecraft after a close flyby of Io on the way out on the other side of Jupiter. You can tell that because we're seeing the night side. What it is supposed to be lighting it up here, I suppose, is artistic license, but other than that, it's a nice accurate painting. And it has just made a close flyby of Io. The way to tell the differences between the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 missions is this. They're both going to the planet. Voyager 2 will go to Uranus if it's able to. They're both going to Jupiter and Saturn. And so in both cases, they will observe those planets. The differences between them are the distance to which they fly past the planet, the angle which they fly past the planet, and therefore which moons they are able to get. And so if you want to remember which spacecraft is doing which mission, simply remember the primary goals and the secondary goals of the science at each of the two planets, Jupiter and Saturn. In the case of Uranus, of course, she has no problem. Only Voyager 2 is going there, if that. The major goals for Jupiter are Jupiter itself and Io. The reason that Io, out of all the moons of Jupiter, is considered to be so important will be obvious to those of you who were here last time. It may be, you know, I told you all these fantastic facts about Io. It may be that Ganymede is just literally we don't know very much about Ganymede, but we do know that Io is a very interesting body, and we also know that it has effects on Jupiter itself. It modulates one of the three types of radio emissions that Jupiter gives out, and so they want to observe Io, and they're going to do a pretty fantastic job of it. Voyager 1 is the one for the prime objective, and so it's the one that goes first to Jupiter, of course, and into Io. Voyager 1 will fly formation with Io for a good third of Io's orbit. And it will not only pass through the flux tube of Io, the term that will make sense of you here last time, it will also make a very close approach to Io and send back extremely high resolution pictures. Pictures not quite as good as it will later send back in Titan. See, there's the main objective at Saturn, so that's Voyager 1 again. But pictures that will show things as small as 100 feet across over much of the surface of Io, which is now essentially totally unknown. And it's going to be just fascinating to see the kinds of landforms you have down there with all that red radioactive salt lying around the ground onto which the entire moon's atmosphere freezes solid and falls four times a week. It should be just unbelievable to see what the landforms would be like. And yet they may be the most familiar. When we see Ganymede, for example, which is made mostly of ice, mostly with water, in fact, with ice on the outside, it may turn out to be even stranger. Voyager 2, then, if Voyager 1 is able to get the primary objectives at a given planet, Voyager 2 will do a different flyby, which will go for secondary objectives, whatever it can get. On the other hand, if at either planet Voyager 1 is not able to make its primary objectives, Voyager 2 will be reprogrammed to do the same flyby as Voyager 1 did. And so you throw away whatever the secondary objectives were to make sure you get the prime objectives. That'll become especially important when we get to Saturn. We can lose Uranus for Voyager 2 if Voyager 1 is not able to get all the Titan observations that we want. And then it's going to be a real agonizing decision. Which is more important, Titan or Uranus? It's really just about a toss-up. Particularly bearing in mind that Titan, you're there for, you've already made it to Saturn. Uranus is another 3 years away. A lot of things could happen in that time. Maybe it would be better to play it safe to go for Titan. On the other hand, one chance in 42 years to see the pole of Uranus. Let's hope that the way it works out, the decision doesn't have to be made. The secondary objective is Jupiter, includes the other three big moons, and we will get particularly good observations of Ganymede, the biggest of them all, from Voyager 2. And in addition, we will get Amalthea. Now, I don't want to imply that only Voyager 1, that only Voyager 2 will observe the other moons, and that the only moon that Voyager 1 observes will be Io. That's not so. But the best observations of Io are from Voyager 1. In fact, 2 gets almost no good observations of Io at all. And the best observations of, say, Ganymede from Voyager 2, although we will get some from 1. So it's not mutually exclusive. But if you just bear in mind what the primary objectives are at each planet, you can keep track of the Voyager 1 mission. Here is Jupiter and Io. Here is a painting which is quite accurate, which shows how close to Io Voyager 1 will get. And this is a diagrammatic representation. This whole left half of the picture is supposed to be the Io end of the flux tube, and it goes up into the skies and comes back down very much smaller and disappears into Jupiter itself. There's a great red spot. That is artistic license. You cannot see the flux tube. Although you may very well, in fact, be able to see an aurora where it hits Jupiter when it does so on the night side. And that is something that we will be looking for very carefully. This is a picture, close-up view of that same model of the Voyager spacecraft in Carmen Auditorium, JPL, of the scan platform. Here are the two cameras, wide-angle and narrow-angle, and there's the infrared instrument, there's the ultraviolet instrument, so on and so forth. Question?
Apertures on the cameras?
You really want me to know a lot, don't you? The correct answer to that question is I haven't the foggiest notion, but as I remember, I just about could have put my outstretched hand across that. Alright. Oh, probably I couldn't. Yeah, so this is a 3-inch or thereabouts. Here is a painting of Voyager 2 at Saturn. And this would, one assumes, this has a little bit of artistic license. It won't get this close to the rings. But still, we'll get some very good observations of them. Now, the primary objectives at Voyager, at Saturn, let's say Voyager 2 at Saturn, I'm sorry, this would be Voyager 1. Primary objectives at Saturn are, of course, Saturn itself, then the rings, and then Titan. Voyager 1 will therefore go for those. The other moons are the secondary objectives, and Voyager 2 will go for those if Voyager 1 succeeds. In addition, Voyager 2 will go on to Uranus. I might mention there are so many moons, and there are so many possible combinations of flybys of one moon after another, depending on the exact date and the exact minute that you get there, that it took over a year to decide among all the possibilities as to which was the very optimum. And you can imagine some of the fights they had. You know, things like trade-offs between a really close flyby of one moon versus not getting another moon at all, and, you know, the other possibility being a more distant flyby of one moon and a better view of the others, and which moons are more important than others, given that we know almost nothing about any of them, and all in all, it must have been a nightmare. No stories of that period have leaked to the outside so far, but if I hear anything, I'll report it to you. It must have been truly fascinating on many occasions. What we will do, though, at Saturn, is pretty spectacular in Voyager 1, and that is you have two ways of studying the planet which are very useful. One is called sun occultation, another is called earth occultation, and this is a way of studying any body that has an atmosphere. What that means is, a sun occultation means what is about to happen here, the spacecraft goes into the shadow of the planet so that in the last few moments the sun shines directly through the planet's atmosphere, as seen from the spacecraft. The spacecraft then observes this eclipse of the sun by the planet, and from the nature of the way the sunlight disappears, you can learn a great deal about the atmosphere of the planet. Remember, please, we are doing this not only visible light, but ultraviolet and infrared as well, not to mention radio. So it should be a tremendous set of data. Earth occultation means the spacecraft flies behind the planet as seen from Earth, so that its radio waves that we receive here on the Earth must traverse the planet's atmosphere on the way to us. And again, you can get a great deal of information about the planet's atmosphere in that way, particularly on these spacecraft, which will be sending back two different frequencies simultaneously. And different frequencies are affected in different ways by different phenomena. So you should be able to separate out those different phenomena. Well, we will have both a Sun and an Earth occultation of Jupiter by Voyager 1. And we will not have one of Io. You have a trade-off between getting a Sun and Earth occultation of Io, or going through the flux tube. We already had an Earth occultation, although not a Sun occultation, of Io from Pioneer 10, and it showed that there's very little atmosphere there. Remember, please, in both of these techniques, you're going to study the atmosphere. So we decided it was more important to fly through the flux tube. One of the things we also had to give up, just a sample of all these trade-offs, you could have had both a Sun and Earth occultation of Ganymede by Voyager 1, but again, you would have lost the flux tube of Io, and you would have lost a few other things. So they decided it was the way to get it. But in Saturn, it turns out you can have your cake and eat it too. You know what a big list is? Person wants to have his cake and eat it too? Okay, in Saturn, you can have three different things. You get a Sun and Earth occultation of Saturn and the rings and Titan. So that is going to be a pretty incredible set of data. What you miss as a result of it is some other moons and so forth. You get those so forth with Voyager 2. And I've already mentioned to you how close Voyager 1 is going to Titan and the incredible resolution of the pictures that we're going to get. If all goes well with Voyager 1, Voyager 2 then flies past on the way to Uranus. There has not been very much decision yet about what to do at Uranus, which moons of it to fly past and so forth. They can make those decisions later on. They won't get there until 1986. And you can make quite small corrections of your trajectory between Saturn and Uranus, which change your arrival time by several days and that kind of thing. So there are all kinds of possibilities, and they'll play that as they go along. I wish that I had an artist concept of Voyager 2 flying past Uranus. Unfortunately, I don't, so you have to imagine that, and we will go on to the next picture. This is the famous recording, the recording that you've been hearing before this lecture and before the one that preceded it. The recording is to take advantage of the fact that both of these spacecraft, after their flybys of their respective planets, will leave the solar system. And they will fly out into interstellar space, literally forever. There is essentially zero chance that an object thrown out at random in interstellar space will ever actually hit a star. The star is simply too small. You may not realize that when you look at astronomical photographs, because the images of the stars there are millions of times bigger than the stars actually should be. In fact, if they were the right size, you would need a powerful microscope to be able to see them at all. So you get the impression when you look at a picture of the Milky Way, there's just a solid mass of stars. Actually, you can fire a bullet right through it, and the chance would be fantastically against you ever hitting a single star. You can fire right through the mural that's part of the Milky Way. If you make a scale model of our part of the universe, and you made the average star, oh, it's about the size of the Sun, which is roughly a million miles across, something like that, a million miles across. Make that 1 millimeter in diameter, 25th of an inch, about the size of a large grain of sand. You would have to put your grains of sand 60 miles apart to have the scale come out right. So the spaces between stars are enormous, even compared with the sizes of the stars themselves. And you're just not going to hit one. It has been worked out what the first encounters of stars will be, if you will use the term encounter rather broadly to mean going within 10 trillion miles or so, and that is about as close as you're going to get. The first encounter is going to be a mere 40,000 years from now, and that is because the star will be doing almost all of the work. The star in question is called AC plus 79 degrees 3888. That means an astrographic catalog, 3,888 stars in the strip of the sky 1 degree wide that is along the line of declination centered on 78 degrees north. And declination is the equivalent of latitude in the sky. So this sort of notation is as though you named villages on Earth by separating the Earth into strips of latitude, each 1 degree wide, and then starting at the Greenwich Meridian, and within each strip, every village you came to, no matter its size, village, town, city, whatever, no matter how far north or south it was within that strip, he gave a number. Number one for the first, number two for the second, number three for the third, and so forth. And so that terminology, he's orienting, might be plus 43 degrees, which is the latitude that we're closest to, 75, 61, if that's the number of towns and villages and cities and hamlets that happen to be between us and the French Meridian. Okay, so this is the same thing in the astrographic catalog. Well, that star at the moment is 17 light years away from us, and if you're not used to thinking in terms of light years, that is almost exactly 100 trillion miles. But it is in the act of making a relatively close approach to the solar system. 40,000 years from now, the voyagers will have traveled only 2.3 light years, or 13.5 trillion miles, and the star will have come in the rest of the distance. And so it's really more a matter of the star passing between the voyagers than the voyagers passing by the star. And so it happens one of it goes by on one side, and the other spacecraft goes by the same star on the other side. Voyager 1, assuming that it does what I told you that it would, that it goes to Jupiter and Saturn, makes all the projections of those planets, will leave the solar system traveling at a speed, which I have here if I can find it, of 38,000, it'll leave the solar system in the late 1987. It'll be traveling at a speed of 38,600 miles an hour, and it will be going in the direction of the northern part of the constellation Ophiuchus, as we see from Earth. Voyager 2 will leave the solar system in mid-1989, if it goes to Uranus and not Neptune, which is the most likely probability given success for Voyager 1, and given no failures on the Voyager 2 spacecraft. So that will be a little bit less than 2 years later. It will be traveling just a tiny bit slower, 300 miles an hour slower, at 38,300 miles an hour. It will be going in the direction of the northern part of the constellation Capricornus. And those two constellations are, you know, like about this far apart from the sky, and the star is going to be in the middle, like so. And so one goes by one, and the other goes by on the other side, and they will pass it effectively, Voyager 1 at 1.7 light years, which is 10 trillion miles, and Voyager 2 in 1.1 light year, much closer approach, a mere 6.5 trillion miles, so it'll be sort of wave as it goes past. Then you have another encounter in a more typical kind of time period. Voyager 2 happens to get the next encounter, and it is 150,000 years after launch. Voyager 1 doesn't encounter that particular star by our definition of what encounter means, and so the next encounter after that is Voyager 1 with a different star, which is 525,000 years after launch. In other words, more than 500,000 years after the flight began, the spacecraft will have come within something of the order of 10 trillion miles of two stars. That's how far apart stars are. Well, in the exceedingly unlikely but not absolutely unprovable possibility that some extraterrestrial culture should happen upon these 12-foot spacecraft in the middle of all that immensity of interstellar space, and we cannot say that there might not be some technology which would enable them to find very small objects, even in among all that immensity, something we can't imagine any more than Neanderthal could have imagined tracking literally orbiting nuts and bolts several thousand miles above the Earth, which we are able to do easily, routinely, by the radars that keep track of all the satellites up there in case someday one of them might not be a satellite but an ICBM. There may be ways of finding it. To identify us to whoever might find it, this two-hour recording has been prepared. A lot of people think it's a gold record. It's not made of copper, but it's gold-plated. And that particular combination should last for literally billions of years to come. On the left there, on the inset, you see a picture of the record itself. On the right, you see technicians installing it on one of the two spacecraft. Each of the spacecraft carries the same record. It's identical. And as you've heard, it has a collection of sounds of Earth, natural and man-made, musical and otherwise, together with some things you have not seen because I don't have copies of them. 155, I think it is, something like that anyway, pictures in audio form, a sort of television equivalent, and they'd be about television quality. So they should know a great deal about us if and when they should find us, undoubtedly billions of years after the human race has evolved into whatever we're going to evolve into or been replaced entirely, which seems more likely. In general, in the paleontological record, the dominant group or species at a given point has not been the ancestor of the next dominant group or species. So the chances are that whatever follows us are not going to be descendants of us. But of course, something new has happened in the evolutionary game, intelligence, and there's no way of knowing how that's going to change it. Well, chances that these records would be found are, of course, very remote, and in reality, their function is to communicate with Earth. To do things like show you how many cultures there are on this planet and how little you know about many of them. To do things like make you think about how one would communicate with intelligent creatures about whom you know absolutely nothing. Not their sense organs, not their way of thinking, not anything whatsoever. And if the record is not a good idea, to think in terms of what would have been better. And that was the real function of the record. This is the plaque which gives instructions on how the record is to be played in forms which should be understandable to anybody who is bright enough to be able to find the thing in the first place. You know, it's not going to be illiterate savages that come across this. It would be people with a high technological civilization. And so what you've got is down there at the bottom a diagram which relates our position in the galaxy to the center of the galaxy and to 14 pulsars, which are astronomical sources that are uniquely identifiable. By examining the record, seeing what it's like, by examining the needle in the cartridge, and by looking at these diagrams, ought to be able to figure out how the record is to be played and how to make a phonograph. So here is a plan view of the record turning around with the cartridge on it. Here is an elevation view of the same thing. There is a code designation along there which indicates how many times the record should turn in 1 second, and expresses that not in terms of a second, but in terms of what should be a universal constant. That is to say, the length of time that it takes on the average for an excited hydrogen atom to flip from the excited state to the ground state. And that gives both the unit of time, which is 1420 million of them per second, and the unit of length, which is 21 centimeters. Any culture which has radio astronomy would have run across that particular emission. It is by far the commonest radio emission in the universe because hydrogen is the commonest substance. So it's a very universal kind of both length and time unit. Well, in those time units, and using binary notation, ones and zeros only, actually there are ones and dashes on this version, this is how many of those time units it should take for the record to go around once. All right? Okay, and the distances and the frequencies of the pulsars are also given in those same time units. This is a diagram of the waveform.